Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Defense Deconstructed on the CGAI Podcast Network. I'm your host and Vice President of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, Dave Perry. On today's show, which we're recording September 18th, 2020, we'll be talking about the Royal Canadian Navy's deployments in an era of great power naval competition with the Commander Maritime Forces Atlantic and Joint Task Force Atlantic, Rear Admiral Brian Santarpia. Admiral Santarpia, welcome to Defense Deconstructed.
Thanks, Dave. It's really an honor to be here and just a joy to talk about these kind of subjects with you.
So to start us off for today, can you get us going by talking about your position and what it entails as a way of starting off the discussion, and then get in a little bit about how your position is involved in the deployment and operations of Canadian Forces warships when they sail?
Right. So as Commander Marlette, I'm in command of a large team here in the Atlantic region that's responsible to force generate all of the maritime effects that we use around the world here around near Canada and everywhere. And that's the first hat we wear. Chief Minister Tom Lazar, who's with me, is my senior chief petty officer. And so he's the formation chief, and he helps us in terms of the man management, the sailor management of that team. Another hat that I'm wearing is Joint Task Force Atlantic, and that's the regional response to crisis here. I work for Commander Seadock in that role. And then the third important hat that I'm wearing is as the Maritime Component Commander to Commander Seadock. And so I think, as you were saying, there's a over the last decade, we've evolved how we command and control all of the Canadian forces on operations. And so where the Navy used to command and control the operations, now the Navy is very much more strictly in the force development of ships and maritime effects, and in the force generation of those effects that we do here on the coast, and as well Bob Ochterlony does on the West Coast. But the actual force employment, when they're in an operation, that's Seadock's responsibility. And so I work for Lieutenant General Coates in that space as the Maritime Component Commander. And so it's interesting. We end up turning a ship over to ourselves often. We'll get a ship ready like HMCS Toronto. She'll get through a workup period, do a bunch of trials, fire some missiles, get herself ready, and then we'll declare that ship as ready to Lieutenant General Coates for employment, and then the Navy will chop that ship over. Admiral McDonald chops it over to Lieutenant General Coates, and then he employs it when it's on an operation like Toronto is now on Operate Assurance. Right after we chop it over, he chops it back to me, and then because we have the maritime experience in the staff here in order to do the day-to-day things. You know, if something breaks in the ship and we need to get a mobile repair team to the ship, those people work for us here in the Navy in the fleet maintenance facility. Or if there's a personnel challenge and we need to get somebody home, we understand the challenges of moving sailors around in a foreign port and around the world. So it just makes sense that we can do a good job for General Coates as the Maritime Component Commander in commanding. But we really do, as the Canadian Forces, want that to be an operation like all the other operations under Lieutenant General Coates.
And so for folks listening, where's the line between a ship just pulling out of the harbor, coming right back in, and an operation? Because I think the ones that you're talking about are I guess, named operations, right? So where's the continuum, and what are the different chunks between a ship that's doing its workup training, which I don't think necessarily has to occur all within Canadian territorial waters. We could have people that are just doing simply the training that they need to do to then go somewhere else and actually do an operation, but that could take them a long way from home sometimes. So where's that kind of continuum fall?
Yeah, it's interesting, and it's not as strict a line as with the other services in between what we think of as force employment, out doing an operation, and force generation, getting elements ready to do those things. It's not as strict a line in the Navy. It's a bit grayer because when you send a ship anywhere, whether you send it strictly for a named operation or you send it because it's working itself up, it sends a message, and that message is important. And the people who receive the message, they don't necessarily think of it in terms of the way we do in terms of force employment or force generation. They do think of it as just a ship going. And so the line is gray. But I would say that for the listeners to understand it, where we need Crown prerogative, where it's a Government of Canada decision to send a ship, then it becomes an operation. And sometimes that Crown prerogative for a big and complex mission like Operate Assurance, that's exercised through a cabinet approval process. And sometimes that Crown prerogative at a smaller mission, like what we do with Op Caribe, where we send ships down to the Caribbean to work with Joint the Jayada South and do the counter-drug mission, that can be exercised by the minister alone with just an order to us to exercise Crown prerogative. But where it's the Government of Canada's decision to send a ship on a mission to achieve a strategic effect, that becomes a mission that CJOC commands, and therefore it comes under us, me as the MCC. Where it's we're just going because we need to have sea time in order to generate the ships, in order to keep the relationships going with our partners, and the Government of Canada hasn't specifically designated that as a mission, then the Navy keeps command of that.
Okay, so with that as a context, what I wanted to really get into with you today is Canada, and particularly in the last several years, has put a lot of focus on how we play a role in supporting the international rules-based order. And on my observation, one of the oldest parts of that is the maritime component of it. All kinds of rules that determine how ships are supposed to interact with each other, and all kinds of rules that are set up to determine how ships are supposed to interact with different pieces of territory. So approaching different national territorial waters, as well as the land. And then the rules that are triggered and come into effect when you get within certain proximities of those other elements. So can you kind of situate for us today? We're in a dynamic right now, and we had a podcast a couple of weeks ago with some folks from CJOC laying out some of the thinking about international operations. And we're in a context today where a lot of people are observing a reemergence of great power competition. And Canada, by virtue of the things that we do with our naval assets, is operating in both of the two areas of the world where that is at play. You were speaking earlier about Operation Reassurance, and I saw just a few weeks ago in the reporting that the Toronto that you had mentioned was following Russian vessels. And of course, we're having this conversation not long after RIMPAC concluded. And then one of our ships is deploying out to help enforce UN sanctions off Korea in a part of the world that China is increasingly contesting. So how does the Navy approach dealing with operating within the rules-based framework at a time when you've got two particular powers that continually are challenging elements of that and then their sort of respective parts of the world?
Yeah, I really appreciate the question because it lets us dig deeply into that idea of great power competition. And as you know, I worked with Dr. Roy and General Anderson, who were on that podcast just in the last couple of years when I was at CJOC. And I agree completely with the way they characterized the situation the world's in now with great power competition, and that we're not in conflict, and I don't think we're in a cold war, but I do think that some countries are very alive to the fact that they are using every element of national power, diplomatic, information, military, and economic, to gain whatever advantages they can in whatever they're trying to accomplish at any given moment. And so they think of their military as a way to gain that advantage, to gain leverage over some countries, such that they can bend the international rule-based order to their advantage in any way they can. They can exploit the parts of the ocean that make sense to them. They can be ready to deny the parts of the ocean to others if that makes sense at any given moment. And I think it applies to all the commons. I think of the maritime commons first, because that's my background and my responsibility. But I think it applies equally in cyber or in space, that all of these areas of common ground for all nations, where no one owns all of it. It can only be organized through either negotiation and law or through power and leverage. And I think that we have to be aware of the fact that other countries are using power and leverage instead of the rule of law to try to gain any advantage they can in the commons in order to further their own personal interests and their own national interests. And I think I don't think that's a surprise to anybody who's thought about it deeply for the last 10 years. But I do think that some Canadians are just now beginning to understand that because we have we're having an academic discussion about it. And I think it's important for us to understand that. So then the Navy's position, it's important. The Canadian Forces doesn't set the policy of Canada. The Government of Canada does it rightfully. And what we do is we provide options for the government to consider how they might use this element of national power. So that the Navy isn't one of many elements of national power. It could be used to reinforce the rule of law by entering into alliances, by being ready to deter other nations' actions in the commons. It's the same thing happens in space and in cyber. Our job, again, build those options. We build options, and then we put those options forward to the government, and then they consider whether selecting that option is in combination with other elements of national power will achieve the effects that they're looking for. It's a pretty complex place to think, and I think that Canada doesn't have a very good security culture. Because we've traditionally been very safe next to America, a long way away from any competitors, we haven't really thought and really protected by that international rules-based order that's existed since the end of the Second World War. We really haven't had to think deeply about people trying to, about other nations trying to compete there. I think now we're facing the fact that we have to be honest about it, that other nations are trying to leverage their power, and then we have to consider how we could deter that, how we could be ready to act against it if we had to, what signals we send if we send a ship, if we don't send a ship, what signals we send if we have the capacity to defend our own networks in cyberspace or our own assets in space. These are the kind of big questions, and that we can only do that as a nation, I think, if we think about it in those ideas, multi-domain, elements of national power, in combination against countries that are competing all the time.
So to take that down to a more tangible and kind of tactical level, as you had said earlier, every time we send a ship somewhere, unless it's just across the harbor that you're looking out your window at right now, we're sending some kind of a message to somebody. And so to the type of options that you're talking about that you present government, how would that apply, or how does that extend to an area where, say, some countries may be largely in alignment with what the international law agreements are about whose waters those are, and other countries are challenging them? So is there current practice right now where you're essentially providing to government options about whether or not, you say, our ship would need to sail from point A to point B? The international rules are that this is a common passageway because it's considered to be international, but it's contested by local parties. What kind of direction does Canadian ship captains always get consistent direction that we adhere to the international rules? Or is that the kind of thing where you're talking about it comes into government to decide about whether or not we'd want to be there to begin with, even though it's considered to be international, or make a decision about whether or not we want to be potentially challenging some people's claim to a piece of real estate, even if it happens to fall outside of what the international legal regime would say is the case?
Right. I mean, so, to get tangible about it, if you take the case of our commitment to NATO, the fact that we've maintained a ship in the standing NATO maritime group continuously since the Russian annexation of Crimea, that was a very overt and clear statement that we stood with NATO in their opposition to allowing the annexation of Crimea. And so the NATO reassurance measures that came into place after that, Canada was a significant part in the planning of that. Those, one of the options was to send a ship as part of the standing NATO maritime group, and to continuously do that. We hadn't been doing it on as continuous a basis in the years before that, and that was an option that the government of Canada saw as something they believed would add value. And selected them. So we've done that ever since. So Toronto is just the latest in a long, long line of ships since 2014 that have been continuously doing that. We don't, Canadian policy is pretty clear. We respect the rule of law. In this case, on the maritime domain, the most important one is the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. The ships that we send out follow that religiously. And so we make sure that our ships understand those rules under UNCLOS, and they absolutely follow them to the letter of the law. There's always a difference of opinion. Some countries believe certain things about UNCLOS, about baselines, and some countries don't. We understand that the Canadian policy space makes sure that our ships' teams are experts in that before they leave, and they follow the Canadian interpretation of UNCLOS. My sense is that in the European space, that hasn't ever been an issue at all it's clear enough. Our allies are all aligned up quite closely with us, and there isn't really an issue in that space at all. I think it's more challenging in the Pacific. There are differences of opinions, and the Canadian policy about whether we would challenge other interpretations of UNCLOS isn't as well developed at this point. I don't think Canadians have had as much time to go through a rigorous understanding of our own policy versus other nations' claims. I think it's really interesting that's developing around the world. It's firming up as we speak. I noticed that this week, the UK, France, and Germany issued a joint letter to the United Nations where they got together and gave a joint interpretation of the policy about claims in the South China Sea. And to that date, they hadn't been nearly that clear. And so you can see countries work their way through these complex issues as of now. Our job in the Navy is to never go beyond what the policy of the government of Canada is, right? So this is a political decision about what that policy ought to be, not a military one. And so in Canada, we make sure that the direction we give to our commanding officers and to the ship's teams that go is such that they follow international law, but they never go past what the stated policy of Canada is.
Listening to an episode of Defense Deconstructed on the CGAI Podcast Network. These engaging conversations from the front lines of policy and politics are brought to you by the Canadian Association of Defense and Security Industries.
So circling back to the fact that other folks are always watching closely, I guess kind of two questions come to mind. One is it the appreciation of the Navy as we are sending ships that other people are paying very close attention and taking cues off what we do or don't do? And then as a follow-on to that, is the type of direction that you need to give to ships before they go out today, is it the case that there's increased attention to those particular aspects of their conduct relative to, say, 10 or 20 years ago? Is that element of kind of the challenging of certain different claims affecting not necessarily the behavior of what Canadians do, but about how explicit a reminder, say, you have to give to your folks before they're actually deploying?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I do think people are paying more attention to what ships are doing in relation to these spaces. I think because the level of tension has risen, I think it's fair and open and common knowledge that the level of tension internationally between China and some other countries is higher than it was before. We have to be really, really careful that we are completely aligned with what the government of Canada's policy is, and that we follow what it is that they seek us to do. I think it's also important as we come forward, you know, if you send a ship, that sends a signal. If you don't send a ship for a long period of time, that sends a signal. If you work with certain countries, that sends a signal. If you don't work with certain countries, that sends a signal. Where, you know, everything can be parsed, and that does make it challenging for planners in headquarters and for ships' captains. But we've got a pretty bright group of people who can work their way through the ambiguity of these things, and these questions tend to stay ambiguous for quite a long time. They don't easily resolve themselves because we're talking about legal interpretations and we're talking about national policies and we're talking about signals that are sent but not explicitly stated, and so it does take a. It does take a pretty clever group of people to work their way through what it is that we want to do on behalf of Canada in accordance with what the government of Canada wants and needs us to do.
And then so the other kind of component to that is the interaction with the other ships that you our folks encounter when they're sailing. During the Cold War, there was this whole kind of architecture built up around how to prevent incidents at sea from spilling over. So in effect, to try and set up rules around what was expected behavior and recognizing that for a number of different reasons, you could have somebody do something outside of the expected behavior, what to kind of do to make sure that you didn't inadvertently escalate a situation purely by accident. And I guess the flip side of that would be of giving greater understanding to other people is that if you did do X, Y, or Z, then that would mean X, Y, or Z and the following implications of having done that. Do those types of frameworks still exist today? So the Soviet Navy's gone, but when your ships are say following the Russian Federation ship, do those types of rules in terms of how you act and interact, do those still apply? And then what's the case if you look at the other theater you're talking about in the Pacific, where we never really had those same types of frameworks in the same types of way?
Right. And so that there is a framework on a bilateral basis with the Russian Federation Navy. We're one of, I think, 13 countries that have entered into a bilateral relationship with Russia to reduce the possibility of conflict and miscalculation. You know, it really does come down to, though, what is common sense safe mariner activity. And so there's the collision regulations about the rules of the road when you're at sea, and every mariner understands those and follows them. And even if another nation's vessel wanted to not follow them, to drive you into such a way to make you veer off, there's a point in any situation between two vessels where the stand-on vessel has to give way in order to avoid collision. It's everyone's responsibility to avoid a collision or to avoid an incident. And so that sort of common sense and following the collision regulations, even if there was no framework, that should allow you to avoid those incidents. And then there are the sort of common sense things like you wouldn't, if you had an aircraft, you wouldn't fly an attack profile that makes it look like you're intending to attack a unit, another ship or another aircraft. And so it's incumbent upon everyone to avoid those situations that would create the possibility of miscalculation. And even if the miscalculation by one side happens, it's incumbent on the other side to figure out how it is that they then avoid escalating it. And so so our sailors, our captains are really well trained. They know how to avoid any situation, and regardless of the framework, they know how to keep the ship safe and avoid that miscalculation. In terms of the Pacific region, there was a set of talks, I think it was 2014, with a bunch of Pacific nations that Canada was involved in, and it created a similar kind of framework with China. But again, More important than the framework is always the understanding of the rules of the road, collision regulations, how to avoid escalating those situations towards miscalculation. And while we've been in close quarters with the forces of both those nations, almost always the conduct of the other nations' navies is highly professional. They understand those rules and those rules of the road. And they understand the importance of not allowing a small tactical situation to escalate. And so so by and large, we haven't really had any incidences.
And it is, I would presume that that's part of the reason why we're trying to make sure that we continually keep ships going out there to make sure that we're understanding the operating framework, participating in RIMPAC, to have that interaction with the other people that we'd be sailing with.
Yeah, absolutely. You need to have some confidence in your own team, that they understand what they're doing, in your allies, that they won't put you into a tough situation, in your command and control network so that you can get back and get direction as required from the operational, strategical, or political levels, and that they can be informed of what's going on. And you need some confidence even in a potential adversary. You need to understand how they're going to react in the situation in case there really is a crisis. As I said, I would not state that there's a crisis in either region now. I just think that there's a level of competition. And so we build options for the government of Canada, we owe it to the government of Canada to be ready for a crisis. And part of being ready for a crisis is working our way through these situations before a crisis, such that the government can have confidence in us in that event.
So as a way of kind of ending the conversation with a return to sort of the big picture, I guess it's common to kind of break out and bucket different types of naval operations. And one of those is generally referred to as a maritime diplomacy type of engagement. I guess in reflecting on what you're saying, and we can still do those sorts of individuals, purely port call type visits, but I guess is it fair to say that effectively every operation that we're engaging in currently has an element of naval diplomacy because of the sort of the signals that we're sending and the message that we're delivering or not delivering about whether or not we're supporting the agreed upon international rules and framework, or whether or not we are potentially opening up some degree of challenge to that on the part of other people, depending on what we do or don't.
Right. You know, we've long taught this concept of Booth's triangle. I don't know if you're familiar with the idea that that naval forces have three roles and that they're balancing between those three roles. Military operations, constabulary work, and diplomacy, and that they're always doing some part of all three, depending on the mission. Given that it might be more heavily weighted to one or two of the three, but that every ship goes out with all three in mind. Ready to do all three all the time.
Well, Admiral, we'll end on an easier question. You're sitting there safely right now in Halifax, a little jealous, ready, as the day we're reporting this in Ottawa, we're going up officially into our second wave. As you're sitting out safely next to the coast, what are you reading?
Yeah, it's a great question. There's this super used bookstore right downtown here called The Trident that serves a great cortado on top of it. But I just picked up a book a week ago or so about the history of China. It's an older book. I can't remember the author's name, but I'm at the point now in the history of China at the Yuan Empire when the Mongols ran China. So it's really a fascinating piece. It kind of goes on a bit. It's one of those books that remind you that history is just one damn thing after another, it seems like. And that's really the case in China. They just go from one damn dynasty to the next, it seems. But it was really quite revealing. I'm just starting to clue into the idea that China's so much more than we think of China as a country. And halfway through this book, I realized that China's not a country. China is an empire. And that the parts of the Chinese empire that have to be held together, that must be an incredible challenge to hold an empire, a very, very diverse, ethnically diverse group of 1.4 billion people together, that they have been trying to hold together. It's waxed and waned over thousands of years. And so it's a really illuminating book.
Okay. Well, Admiral Santarpia, thanks again for taking the time to join us today on Defense Deconstructed.
Yeah, thanks so much, Dave.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of Defense Deconstructed, part of the CGAI Podcast Network. If you like the show, please remember to rate us and leave a comment on your podcast app. And if you like our stuff, please feel free to check out our donation page at cgai.ca/support. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. The podcast is brought to you by our team in Ottawa, and thanks go to our producers, Charlotte Duval-Antoine and Drew Phillips, for providing our music. I'm Dave Perry, and thanks for listening to this episode of Defense Deconstructed.